Our next speaker is Dr. David Andrews, Professor of Human Development and Family Science at The Ohio State University and Assistant Director of Extension and Director of 4-H Programs in Ohio. Prior to this, he was professor at Oregon State University and a research scientist at one of the premier intervention centers in the nation, the Oregon Social Learning Center. Over the past 15 years, Dr. Andrews has developed, implemented, and evaluated a series of programs for adolescents and their parents. His recent projects have been funded by the National Institute of Mental Health and the National Institute of Drug Abuse, and have largely focused on testing the effectiveness of community and school-based programs in the prevention of drug use, antisocial behavior, and other problem behaviors of youth. Like our other speakers today, his work is distinguished by an ecological orientation, meaning that he does not study an adolescent as an isolated individual in a psych lab, but rather he studies the influence of the youth's real-world social contexts like family, peers, school, and community. He's a frequent speaker at events ranging from national scientific conferences to local workshops for parents and teachers. On an informal note, I am intrigued by a scholar whose vita tells me that he got the IAMS Pet Food Company to chip in $65,000 toward a study in which youth and their pets served as companion animals in therapeutic interventions with the elderly and the handicapped. It's a good idea. I think it benefits the elderly. The youth probably get a lot out of it. I'm sure the dogs did. Please welcome the only psychologist I know who is funded by a pet food company, Dr. David Andrews.
Thank you. Karen has her obituaries, and my claim to fame is hitting up pet food companies for money. Actually, that is one of our new and exciting projects. We hope to continue to look for any opportunity to get young people engaged in activities that provide them some leadership skills and some opportunities to learn and work with adults, but also to be engaged in community service. And I'm very excited about being here for several reasons. One of the reasons is left already. One of the reasons I was excited because I like these little pointers. I love these things. Except I always want to zap somebody with it when I get one of those. But the other reason I'm excited is you have a very distinguished group of speakers here and an audience with a similar level of dedication to trying to create solutions for our young people. And it's very exciting to participate in this. It's sometimes difficult sitting up here because I'm kind of sitting on my hands and biting my tongue because I want to and jump in and add things. Many good comments have already been made this morning, and I hope that what I can present to you will add to that. And I'm going to start with an overhead that I use. You talked about middle schools and the difficulty of dealing with middle schools. This is an overhead that I like to use with seventh graders. I was experimenting one day, and you can see how dirty it is that seventh graders have actually been handling this overhead. And this comes from a colleague of mine, Michael Godfredson, who's actually a criminologist, and he went through the literature and tried to look at deviancy, drug use, delinquency, all types of characterizations of deviancy in young people, and then project out some age trends related to that deviancy. And one of the things I do with seventh graders is I just do the same thing I'm doing with you. I throw it up there with very little information about what's going on, except to say on the deviancy refers to a number of problem behaviors that people experience. And the bottom is simply age. And the yellow is a very low-risk group, and the red is a very high-risk group. And then I ask them a series of questions about this. Well, interestingly, the first thing, I say, what do you notice when you see this? And their most likely comment is, well, when you're 65, you don't get into any trouble at all. And I say, well, that's a brilliant observation. Why don't we back off of that a little bit and look at some things that may be more relevant to you as an individual. And when you do this, they are very quick to come up with the same things that we would come up with or that I would be able to get graduate students to come up with in a graduate seminar. And I'd like to point those out. If we had an hour or two in a workshop, I'd make you do the work, but I'll help you here. One of the things that should jump out to you immediately is that the shape of the distribution is the same for the low-risk group and the high-risk group. We don't see major differences. It has major implications for what we do in the shape. But you'll also notice that even at the very beginning, and this really is not at birth, except because we have some measurement limitations, but from the beginning, there is a difference in the low-risk group and the high-risk group, but a slight difference. And within, as I talk later, I'll talk about within the first 3 or 4 years of life, that difference gets bigger. You can see by the time they're 5, there's a larger difference in the rate of deviancy in the high-risk group than the low-risk group. But you'll see then at about the age of 11 to 20, there's this major escalation in the high-risk group that is not accompanied by a major escalation in the low-risk group. There is an escalation, but not to not nearly the degree. If you look at by the time we reach maturity or the end of adolescence, the low-risk group is basically half as much deviancy as a high-risk group. So what we want to try to do is create a similar or to reduce the escalation in that high-risk group. But the implications are that everybody needs prevention. And the implications are, I love to do this with my undergraduate students because they're like right at the peak, you know. And what we're saying by this is you are likely, whether you're a squeaky clean, never been in any kind of trouble kid, or one of the worst problems that we have in society, you're both likely to peak in young adulthood. You're both likely to peak around 18 to 23. Now, the other implications for criminologists is if we wait long enough, these things fall off. You know, if you just wait it out long enough. But it has major implications for us in terms of prevention as to where we target our energies. Because one might say that we target energies early in the process before the gap widens between the low risk and the high risk group. Others would say we need to tackle the problem at the point where there's the most escalation, which would be the 11 to a 15-year-old range, is where we're really starting at the early escalation period. But I want you to frame this and put this in the back of your mind because we'll come back to it as we talk about the rest of the presentation. Now, the next one is one of the most well-used overheads that I've ever known, and I guarantee you it's on page 41 in your book, which, by the way, is an excellent resource for you. You should sleep with that book because it has everything in it that you need to know in terms of at least the recent history of what we know about prevention. All of the major works are represented there, and it's very well done and I think very objective, and Karen has done and her staff's done a great job synthesizing that information. So on page 41, you'll see this diagram, and I guarantee you, if you have an opportunity to get in front of a group and talk about the emergence of problem behaviors in young people, this will be one that you might want to pull out and use. And by the way, this was done by Gerald Patterson at the Oregon Social Learning Center several years ago, and he's one of the premier experts in the country on prevention programs for problem behavior, and this is one of his more popular pieces. And you do have permission to use that from Jerry. What I want to point out here, and you can follow along, is a trajectory of how young people, a typical pattern of how young people get engaged in problematic behavior. And you can see the roots of this pattern, and we call it the vile weed of problem behavior because of the way that it grows and takes on kind of a life of its own and how difficult it is to terminate some of these things. The roots of it are in antisocial parenting or antisocial parents themselves, not just unskilled parents, but one of the things that we need to recognize is that we have parents who themselves are antisocial, who are trying then to guide the next generation away from antisocial types of behavior. Unskilled grandparents who are a generation back from the lack of skills of the parents, certain stressors on the family, the child temperament. Child temperament plays a major role in starting the process, and parent substance abuse. But very early, after you get above the roots, very early in the process, poor discipline and monitoring in families begins to create a cycle of coercion and trains kids very early in life to get their way by being coercive, and inappropriate limit setting, inconsistency in discipline, and really lack of monitoring and supervision are the primary things that contribute to this. So we see by the time children are 4 or 5 years of age, you have an antisocial profile for kids. It is very, very predictable. And it comes through this coercive process. Now, all kids are challenging, and all kids are likely to try to engage you in a coercive kind of process. And coercion is simply what happens when you go to the grocery store and they grab that box of cereal and they want it, and your reverend walks down the aisle right next to you and they're saying, "I want it," and you've already said no, and they know if they up the stakes just a little bit by screaming a little bit louder and persisting, or maybe falling on the floor and kicking their feet a little bit and turning a little bit blue, that perhaps you will try to avoid the embarrassment of that and give in. And so the next time they grab that cereal box, as soon as you give in, tantrum goes away, things get better, everybody moves on. Next time they grab the box, you're more likely to give in, they're more likely to scream and throw a tantrum. Now this happens in all normal parenting. But the families that we've worked with at the Oregon Social Learning Center have a history of engaging in these coercive types of exchanges. So young people learn this coercive process, and then they start to get into a school setting, a preschool setting, and they get around other young people. Other young people don't play this way. Other four-year-olds, they could care less. You can escalate all you want. Try to be coercive. They've got the same strategies to work with you. They won't back off. And friendships with other kids are very different than parental relationships. They're different in the fact, in the sense that parental relationships aren't easily terminated. Friendships are self-selected. So if you pitch a tantrum with a bunch of other 4 or 5 year olds, they just isolate you. They leave you alone. So very soon that isolation leads to low self-esteem. The kids start dropping off in their social skills. Then they enter into school. And when they enter into school, they're having so many social problems that other peers begin to reject them. They're still involved in this coercive process. Parents begin to reject them. Parents begin to throw up their hands. By the time an antisocial child is 10 or 11 years of age, parents are saying, "Huh, they're a handful. I can't deal with them anymore. Don't want to." What does that do to monitoring? Helps them turn the other way. If I don't know about it, I don't have to deal with it. So you get a certain degree of peer rejection and parent rejection, depressed mood, academic performance starts to drop off, and then between stage 2 and stage 3, they enter into middle school. And that was a wonderful comment about the structure of middle schools. We send them to a place where they are less supervised, there are more children that are just like they are, they typically are further away from their home, they have much more independence and freedom, and this is when their behavior starts to escalate. It's not the fault of middle schools, but it's the fault of developmentally, we start to allow kids more time, more freedom, more independence, less structured activities. Many of these young people haven't developed the skills to be positively engaged in other youth types of activities, so they have big chunks of time when they're on their own. And they find each other. In stage 3, they start finding each other in deviant peer groups. It's incredible how fast middle schoolers who have been isolated in elementary school. Why are they isolated in elementary school? Because there's one per class. The percentage of highly antisocial kids, about 5%. So teachers get together. If there's 3 classes of 5th graders, teachers get together and they separate the 3. They separate those 3 kids because they know what will happen if they put them in the same classroom. When they dump them into middle school, those middle schoolers all get together, and within weeks they formed a deviant peer group. Substance use goes up, delinquency takes off, and the pattern starts to cycle until you get to an adult pattern of chaotic employment, drug use, sometimes institutionalization, disrupted marriages, and long-term consequences of this behavior. So what do you do about it? Well, one of the things that we've done about it is developed a program called the Adolescent Transitions Project. And in this project, we focused on this 7th grade group. And some would say you need to start earlier. There are some problems with starting earlier, especially if you're trying to measure impact. One of the things that came up in terms of an earlier presentation was, you know, you start with 11-year-olds and you have to measure intentions to use. Or you start with 10-year-olds, you're measuring intentions to use. You won't get the full-blown pattern of substance use till they're 17 or 18 years of age and getting the funding to carry that on. So we decided to use 7th graders. We did a 12-week parent training class, 6 to 8 groups of parents together. 6 or 8 families together, and there were about 100. There were 158 people in the study. 119 of those assigned to different types of intervention. One group went through parent training only. The parents got together once a week for 12 weeks, 90 minutes each. They covered such things as identifying problems, pinpointing and tracking, supervision skills, setting limits, which is a discipline-oriented session, communication, peer influences on problem behavior so parents could understand that, and how to get support from each other over a 12-week period. Another group participated in teen-only types of groups. So the same teens from those families would get together, six or eight of those would get teens would get together in a group, again, 12 weeks, 90 minutes, working on similar types of things but without the discipline and the supervision pieces. How to get along with friends, refusal skills, again, going back to identifying problems and pinpointing a strategy for attacking those problems for them personally. And communication, peer influence is the same parallel sets of activities. Well, I want to share with you some results of that because I think it has some implications for what we need to talk about in putting together effective programs. One of the things that we were interested in is if coercion is really a problem in these families and has led to a high degree of negative affect and conflict in those families, can we in 12 weeks, by working with the parents, and this is data from the parent group, active parent groups, can we put together a program that will reduce negative engagement? And we measured this in several ways. We had a fairly extensive budget, so we did we do a lot of videotaping, 25 minutes of videotaped family interactions, and it's incredible what families will do in front of a tape. I'm just always amazed. Somebody said, "Well, won't they put on their best face in front of the tape?" Well, yes, but it's not good enough. It's the bottom line. They can't hold it together. So we do baseline and termination observations. We also do what we called weekly and monthly telephone calls, where we call at different times and they ask them very specific things about what happened today. How many fights went on? How many arguments went on? What kind of conflict was going on in the family? And then we have them do some survey instruments as well. Combine those, get a little Z-score kind of thing so we can combine those things. And really what you see is a very, very clean pattern. Mothers going down from baseline to termination in the amount of negative engagement. Children the same way. We didn't have enough data to do fathers. Fathers show up sporadically. We dropped them from all of the analysis in this particular approach because we didn't have enough to deal with the sample size issues that we needed. So we pulled it down and just dealt with mothers. So it's a very similar pattern. So we felt pretty confident with this. This also translated into behavioral differences as reported by school teachers and as reported by the children themselves and the parents. So if we composite those things, types of things, improvements in the amount of conflict and aggression at school exhibited by the child, improvements in grades, many different indicators that would show that these reductions in family negativity translated into behavioral things in the children that were very positive. Now, the next thing I want to show, though, is that when you do that, when you try to look at many indicators, and I just pulled one, tobacco use, so we could focus on substances. When you look at what we did with the young people in their peer groups, when we brought them together and compared it to the control, by most of our measures, those that we brought together with National Institute of Drug Abuse money got worse. Pulling them together, regardless of what we did with them over a 12-week period, they tended to escalate above the control group if we'd left them alone. And so we went back and we looked at the videotapes of all of these sessions. And it's incredible the amount of garbage that goes on in these peer groups when you get six or eight kids together that are all high risk. And it should be intuitive from all of our other information that regardless of what we try to do, when we bring together six to eight high-risk kids in any setting, the correctional system will tell you this is true for sure. If you want to get them escalating in their rates of problem behavior, bring them together. I give you an example of what happened at tobacco use, and the reason I pulled this one out is because it has the most impressive data at one-year follow-up. 1 year after, look at the difference between the control group and the peer group. And we have enough confidence in our statistics and in our other data that goes beyond tobacco use to make some pretty strong suggestions that whatever we do, we really need to look at not focusing on bringing groups of kids together in groups for any reason. We need to look at heterogeneous types of groupings of high-risk kids rather than homogeneous. Our best intentions in these therapeutic settings, very few people have been able to bring together groupings of high-risk kids and do anything with them. Yet it's one of our common strategies that we use. So moving on to finish up, let me summarize some implications. And they're not any different. Yeah, they're not any different from things that you've heard earlier. We have to focus on building positive adult relationships. And the best place to start with that is with parents. We have to focus on that. Whether we're starting with 3 to 5 year olds, 10 or 11 year olds, improving that positive adult relationship. If it's not happening through parental work, it needs to happen through other youth organizations, through other places where kids come into contact. And I agree with the statement on the ratio. We need about one adult for every 7 kids participating in these programs to have a positive impact. Has to be sustainable over time. And I also agree that one size doesn't fit all. We need to target our interventions for kids that have, put this up right here. We need to target interventions so that we have something for a primary prevention approach. That is, all kids need it, total inoculation. We also need something for a secondary approach. These are high-risk kids like we dealt with. They're high-risk, but they aren't fully engaged in problematic behavior. They're just starting to sample that. And we also need tertiary or full intervention kind of things. But what we need to recognize in that, and I'll close with this, is that as we move through the continuum of primary interventions or prevention work to tertiary work, the number of youth we can reach go down, or the number of youth we need to reach go down, because there are fewer kids that are involved in those high-level types of problematic behaviors. But the resources we put into that goes up. And so at some point, there's a break-even point around secondary intervention where the lines intersect. The resources it takes to deal at the tertiary level of full-blown intervention for the number of kids that it serves really makes us take a closer look at moving back towards universal preventions, and my indications are that the best bang for the buck is at the secondary level. So we can talk about that later in the day.
Questions for David? Are there differences in best strategies for girls versus boys?
Well, I think the biggest difference, first of all, we use a generic approach of increasing supervision and discipline with both boys and girls. What we find in the outcome is that girls tend to, the same types of parenting behaviors tend to lead to internalizing types of behaviors in girls, mood disorders, eating disorders, more internal types of things, external aggressive kind of things in boys. But the strategies we use were basically the same. Now, in the groups, the parents of girls come in dealing with much more emotional, affective kind of issues than the parents of boys. But we pretty much treated them the same in the groups with the basic profile.
Does parental employment influence these processes?
I don't think it's necessarily employment. It's the arrangements they make for young people that are unsupervised, whether they're indirect or direct levels of supervision. Some of the strategies that we taught were, how do you get kids engaged in activities where somebody else is helping you to supervise? One of the most difficult things for parents to do, and this relates to employment, would be to call the friends. Some of the kids would say, well, I go every afternoon over to John's house. So we actually taught high-risk parents how to get to know John's parents so that you would get information for them. So it's not so much the employment. It's if employment leads to large blocks of unsupervised time that kids have in unstructured activities, then it's a factor. But otherwise, we didn't find it a big factor.
Do you have long-term follow-up data?
Yeah, they last for about 6 months and then starts to taper off. So after a 2-year, they're into 2-year follow-up at Oregon Social Learning Center on these, and there are not significant differences now between the groups. So they have watered it down, which is a clear indication that, you know, we need sustainable types of contact and support. Yeah, good question. Well, those were two different groups. Let me clarify that. The first chart that I put up there were kids whose parents had gone through the program compared to kids whose parents hadn't. The second group was a group of kids who had gone through the peer the peer training, their parents hadn't gone through anything. The kids went through the peer training alone. And that was compared to a control group in that group. Now, one of the interesting groups that we had was a group of, we thought we'd get double bang if we put peers going through a teen focus and parents going through at the same time. And our original hypothesis was that would be the best condition. But what happens when you look at that condition, they wash each other out. The negative impact of participating in a teen group washes out the positive impact, and they look relatively flat. They looked about like the control group. So it's the teen-only group that got worse and the parent-only group that got better.